Accession number 20496, Reel 5.
Edwin Drew, Reel 5.
The Admiral in charge of the ocean escort of three cruisers was Rear Admiral Bob Burnett. He was a physical training fanatic, but he was a man who gave tremendous confidence. He was a real... His personality was so appreciated by ships' companies. He had a word for everybody. But if ever a man needed help on the occasion of the Scharnhorst, he did. And yet he, on his own, virtually, he was able to deliver Scharnhorst to the home fleet for sinking. We, of course, were in Scapa at the time, and it wasn't until it was all over and Bob Burnett had returned with his three cruisers to Scapa that we learnt the true facts. And it appears that Bob Burnett's group picked up by radar the Scharnhorst in extreme misty conditions and closed and opened fire. And there was an exchange of gunfire for I don't know how long, I can't remember now, but Scharnhorst sheered off into the mist, and Bob Burnett was left with the decision of what to do. Of course, he'd informed the home fleet, who were in position around Iceland awaiting such a situation. Bob Burnett told us that I said to myself, if I was in charge of the Scharnhorst, where would I go? And he said, I decided where I would go, and I went there with my three cruisers, and there I found the Scharnhorst. And those were his very words. Where this was and which course he took, I do not know. But he was able then to engage the Scharnhorst again. I believe Norfolk was able to secure hits, but it was evident that Scharnhorst was going to make for Alton Field, and the presence of the home fleet prevented that, and she went northwards and up round the North Cape and eventually near Zemlya, the island in the Norwegian Sea to the north of Norway and Russia, she was sunk. My only recollection, apart from the words of Bob Burnett afterwards, was on the night that the Scharnhorst was sunk. I was in the engineer's office of the Bermuda, and of course we knew that the action was taking place. And the chief yeoman of signals rushed down on his way back to the skipper's cabin and shouted in the engineer's office, we've got her, we've got her at last. I've just received a signal to say that from CNC to ships, illuminate the target with star shell. And that was the end of Scharnhorst. And there were some 30-odd survivors, I understand, out of some 1,800 or so crew.
Under what circumstances did Admiral Burnett speak to you about hunting for the Scharnhorst?
When he came back from from the sinking, and he'd come back to Scapa Flow, then of course he was only too anxious. As I say, his personality was such he wanted everybody to understand what had happened, how it had happened, and it was, in his words, it was just fortunate that it happened to be Team A who got the accolade and not you boys in Team B. And that was that. We, apart from Murmansk runs, we were diverted down to the tail of the bank at Greenock on the Clyde, and on one occasion in about October 42. We took aboard American officers, army officers, British army officers, and several large wooden crates. And as soon as these were aboard, we steamed off and for Gibraltar. And we steamed at 30 knots all the way down to Gibraltar. And of course, we didn't know what was happening, why we'd gone to Gibraltar. But eventually, of course, it came clear that it was the North African landing in Algiers. And the officers we took down were the senior American officers who were landed at Gibraltar. And subsequently, we learnt that the wooden crates that we'd taken down were new currency for Algeria once the invasion had taken place. And during the landing, we were attached to the famous Force H, and which had a tremendous history of success in the Mediterranean, despite tremendous odds against them. We bombarded Algiers at the time that the initial landing took place. That's as far as I really can say. We were in action against German torpedo bombers for quite a time on one evening, but without any success on their part. Neither did we shoot any down, but it was quite a stirring action. And then back, of course, we came to, when that was all over, we came back to Scapa and off again on Murmansk convoys until the summer of 1943. I think it would be 43. We were sent down to Plymouth and we subsequently learnt that we were to act as, again, on our own, to act as ocean escort in the Bay of Biscay to cover Captain Walker's anti-U-boat flotilla. For the first time, we had been able to detach anti-U-boat ships to actually cut off their retreat into the French Atlantic ports. The problem was that in Bordeaux there were 12 German destroyers, and it was protection against these that Captain Walker needed some heavier ships. It was an interesting time because it was the time the Germans brought out the glider bomb, and nobody knew how to counteract this bomb, whether it was directed by, affected by sound or what it may be, and all sorts of various ideas came into being, but in eventually the only thing to do was to shoot the thing down, that was all.
Did you see any of those?
We didn't see any bombs, no, but they were being used all the time around that area. The other interesting thing was that, of course, as I explained, Bermuda was a modern ship and she had all the modern equipment, and we carried a fighter direction officer, and his job was to act as in liaison with the RAF fighters and to direct them from radar contacts that we had from the ship. And it was quite interesting that on several occasions out in the bay, we were able to see on one side of the ship German aircraft, and on another side of the ship in the sky British fighters, and in another part of the ship Coastal Command Sunderland flying boats who were on anti-U-boat patrols, and yet none of them were actually converging on each other. None of these flights were converging on each other, and until Air Fighter Direction Officer was able to get in touch with the RAF fighters and put them on to the German planes. I'm sure it was far more sophisticated than that, but as far as an engineer officer was concerned, that's what it looked like. That was really the last. We then went back to Scapa and we did Murmansk convoys again until June 1944, when I was appointed after 2 years in Bermuda. And that was the normal time of an officer's commission in a ship, 2 years. I was appointed to a shore base at Rosyth as a divisional officer at the Royal Naval Artificer Training Establishment at Rosyth. And I was then...
When you were on the Arctic convoys, did you personally run into the enemy with Bermuda?
No. We had no contact at all with aircraft, surface ships, or U-boats. I think the U-boats and the aircraft would concentrate on the convoy. They would be, that was the important thing. They could leave us alone. We didn't mind, of course, how rough the weather was. And, or in the initial stages, how dark it was, because the rougher the weather, the less chance of U-boat attack, because submarines cannot surface, or they find it extremely difficult to surface in rough weather, and once on the surface, of course, they find it extremely difficult to submerge. So the rougher the weather, the better. And that was it, really. The big problem, of course, was ice. In those where we were operating, spray coming over the ship just froze solid on the deck, and that provided a top weight, which increased the risk of capsizing. And so it had to be cleared away as quickly as possible using steam hoses. And this was a constant exercise every day to get rid of ice off the ship.
Who did that?
Oh, well, it was the ship's company using steam hoses.
Did you personally do it?
No. I mean, it was the lads who did it, as I might say.
What were living conditions in the ship like on Arctic runs?
Oh, perfectly good, very good. Very good, in fact. By that time of the war, of course, we were getting better food, and being in a modern ship, it was all the modern conveniences were there.
Any memories of your period at Rosyth?
Well, being ashore after 5 years afloat was quite strange. The training officers, if I can use that, the technical training officers were all The technical training officers were retired RN officers who'd been called back at the beginning of the war and were using their skills in order to assist with training of artificers at various establishments around the country. The engineer and electrical artificers were trained at Rosyth and at Devonport. And there were some, let me just try and to think, there were four, eight. At any time, there were something like 250 apprentices on training. My job was lecturing in the evenings and on engineering issues and acting as a divisional officer to two divisions of apprentices. Apprentices were 16. They came in at 16 and they left at 20, when they were 20. It was a 4 years training course, and it was an excellent course, excellent. The standard of skills attained by these chaps is remarkable. It's remarkable what could be done just using hands and eyes and ears. Of course, manual work that the apprentices carried out in the workshops are now, of course, carried out by computer-controlled equipment, and in one way, the skills of manual skills are no longer developed. No, it was an interesting episode. I was up there for 18 months, and finally, I was demobilised in December 1945.
Did this training establishment, was it called HMS something or other?
Well, no, it wasn't. It was called the Royal Naval Artificer Training Establishment, Rosyth. Subsequently, it was called... originally, it was called HMS Caledonia. And it was started in the old transatlantic liner, the Majestic, which the Admiralty bought and berthed in Rosyth, and was used as a training establishment for while the camp was being built. And so it was called HMS Caledonia. I can't think, subsequently after the war, she was given an HMS name, and I can't remember whether it was Caledonia or not. I'm getting mixed up with the officer training establishment down at Plymouth, which was called HMS Thunderer.
Well, don't worry, that's on record anyway.
Yeah.
How do you feel now about having served in the Navy in the Second World War?
Oh, I mean, when I started, I joined the RMVR because I wanted to be in the Navy if there was to be a war. I've never regretted it, and I learnt a tremendous amount in man management, in technical skills, in dealing with difficult problems, and that was it. No regrets at all.
Which was your happiest ship in the war?
I think that must be Bermuda. I think that must be Bermuda. It was the first time that I really joined a ship at the, along with the rest of the ship's company, and we grew together as a team, whereas as far as Cornwall was concerned, I joined her after she'd been come back from the China station after the outbreak of war, and as I've explained, she never went home, and she spent the rest of the time out in the Indian Ocean virtually, and the ship's company, whilst they were they put their effort into it, there was the feeling that they ought to have been given some extra leave. But of course, in those days, ships were short, duties were unlimited, and the manpower had to be second rate to the demand, the national demand. So that all had its effect on Cornwall, the crew in Cornwall. This doesn't mean in any way that they were not a team, they were. But as far as I was concerned, I joined them halfway through their commission from the time the war broke out to the time she was sunk. I joined them about halfway through, and so it wasn't a team like we formed in Bermuda.
Was there such a thing as your unhappiest ship?
No ship that I was on was unhappy. No ship was happy. Once you're cooped up in a ship, as we could be in Cornwall, and you were on 30-day patrols, as she was capable of carrying out, and then coming back into port and fueling, and then leaving again on a 30-day patrol with no mail, no nothing, it gave all the seedbed for discontent. That type of situation, but there was a lot of moaning to start with. But once the decision was made, and that was, they settled down and pulled their weight. So no unhappy ship, but Cornwall's crew did have a rough time.
You were telling me earlier off the record something which you might like to put on the record, something about the number of stripes which engineer officers got.
All RNVR officers were appointed as probationary, temporary, sub-lieutenant RNVR. If you were an engineer officer, you got probationary, temporary, sub-lieutenant brackets, E, close the brackets, RNVR. If you were a dentist, it was a D in brackets. If you were a supply rating, it was no, that's not true. What else was there? Well, that's good enough. At age 25, you were promoted to, by that time, you were expected to have achieved efficiency with a watchkeeping certificate, either as an upper deck officer or an engineer officer. You were then, of course, a temporary lieutenant, RNVR, at age 25. Unless, of course, there was some reason you had specialised skills and a higher rank was needed. I never understood this, but anyway, that was there were plenty of people who came in with senior rank to me. And as I've explained, in the Royal Naval Engineer Officers, they came afloat with no experience at all, apart from the equivalent of an engineering degree, with two stripes. And until I was 25, I didn't get my second stripe. So technically, and as far as the ship was concerned, I was senior to these RN officers, engineer officers. But of course, on rank, I was junior. So I went as far as I think I've already explained. I started in Bermuda as engineer officer number 3, and after 2 years, I left the ship as engineer officer number 5. But that was because RN officers kept joining the ship, were trained up, and then were, of course, senior. Does that answer your question?
It does, yes. Thank you.